Thanks very much. It's been a long day, so let's have fun. So I'm going to be talking about some non-commutative algebras which arise when you study D-brains at singularities. There's a point of view which says that specifying this non-commutative algebra is just as good as resolving the singularity, and I'm going to try to explain some of the features of the non-commutative algebras which lead to that notion. Now, almost all of the discussions of these algebras and of the non-commutative structure have been done in the context of so-called non-compact Calabi-Yau manifolds. So these are typically affine varieties which have trivial canonical bundle in dimension 3. And at the end of the talk, I'm going to attempt to explain a program for possibly globalizing this construction. Not all the details are worked out for that program, so it's a little bit tentative. But I think it's possibly going to work, and I think it helps to clarify the role that these non-commutative algebras may end up playing. So D-brains are something which were introduced into string theory in 1995. Prior to the introduction of D-brains, string theory was thought of as a theory of strings, but people started to realize that there were other extended objects in string theory in 1995. And in the original formulation due to Polchinski, D-brains were regarded as submanifolds on which strings can end. But it was also observed that those submanifolds had to support a gauge field that was confined to the submanifold, which provided a gauge degree of freedom at the endpoints of the string. So, of course, the original formulation was just an empty space in flat space, but people are interested in string theory in studying so-called compactifications of string theory, where you use some of the dimensions, some of the 10 dimensions of space-time, to give an effective physical theory in 3 plus 1 dimensions, and you compactify the other ones. So the typical thing to do is to take a Calabi-Yau threefold. And if you want the D-brains to preserve supersymmetry, then they should be supported on a calibrated submanifold of the Calabi-Yau threefold. There are two calibrations that are relevant. One is the Kähler calibration. The other is the special Lagrangian calibration. And the special Lagrangian case is a really interesting case. It's something which I won't talk about today. Today I'm going to focus on the D-brains that are supported on complex submanifolds. So in version one of the story, well, an algebraic geometer can rest assured that the gauge field will have its physics dictated by the physical theory, but there is something from algebraic geometry to take as an input to that, which is a holomorphic vector bundle that's supported on this submanifold. So what we really need for deep brain theories, at least the part of them that goes in the compact spacetime, is a complex submanifold of the Calabi-Yau threefold and a holomorphic vector bundle supported on that submanifold. So that was version one of the deep brain story. In version two of the deep brain story, algebraic geometers immediately say, hey, I know what a vector bundle that's supported on a submanifold is. That's a coherent sheaf. And people ask the question, could we make sense of other coherent sheaves as being D-brains, and sense has been made of that. So there's a second version of the story in which you regard as data for specifying a D-brain an element of the category of coherent sheaves on X. And then, as almost everybody here knows, there's another version of this, the topologically twisted string theory, in which the natural structure is not the category of coherent sheaves itself, but the associated derived category, the bounded derived category of coherent sheaves on the Calabi-Yau manifold. And this is version three of the D-brain story. It applies to topologically twisted D-brains. And remarkably, it was anticipated by Koncevich's homological mirror symmetry conjecture, which was published in 1994, a full year before anybody wrote down what a D-brain was. So Koncevich's homological mirror symmetry conjecture relates the bounded-derived category of coherent sheaves on X to the Fukuya category, which is related to the special Lagrangian submanifolds on the mirror partner. That's a really beautiful conjecture, but since I'm not talking about special Lagrangians today, aside from making this historical observation, I won't have much to say about homological mirror symmetry. So, I mentioned that after the introduction of D-brains in 1995, it became apparent that string theory was not purely about the strings, but that the other objects in string backgrounds, such as these D-brains, played important roles. And one way to try to understand the role that D-brains are playing in the physical theory is to study intrinsically the gauge theory, which is defined on these D-brains. So if you directly consider the gauge theory, again, on a supersymmetric brain, so in flat space or with the maximum amount of supersymmetry possible, you would find a Yang-Mills theory with maximal supersymmetry. You would find a gauge group UN when the corresponding vector bundle had rank N. And that would be part of the data of the physical world around us that had to be specified if the physical world is represented by a compactification of string theory with D-brains involved. In fact, we can do more than just we can do something more than just put the D brains at a singular point. Excuse me. Yeah, I'm just repeating what I said in this paragraph. So if I just take D3 brains for definiteness and put them at a point of the Calabi-Yau manifold, then the labeling is a little bit funny. For those who don't know, a DP brain occupies P spatial dimensions, but a total of P plus 1 space-time dimensions. So if you want a D brain that fills the ordinary 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time, it's a D3 brain that you use. And then in the transverse space, it should just be a point. So we have a complex submanifold of complex dimensions 0 and a bundle on it, which isn't too much information. That's a point on the Calabi-Yau manifold. Well, there is some information because the point could have multiplicity. Right? So you could have a point with multiplicity on the Calabi-Yau manifold. That would lead to a super Yang-Mills theory in four dimensions as the associated physical theory. But more generally, we could take our collection of D-brains and put those D-brains at singularities. And very interesting features happen when you put them at singularities. Just a couple of remarks about this. So there's a class of singularities, orbifold singularities, which had been recognized from the early days of string theory as playing a special role in string theory. It turns out that the string theory, when formulated on target spaces with orbifold singularities, is perfectly non-singular, even though the target space is singular. And so fairly quickly after the introduction of D-brains, starting with work of Douglas and Moore, people started to wonder what would happen if the D brains were placed at singularities, not just the strings. In other words, what would open string theory near an orbifold point be? Some interesting phenomena, including something called brain fractionation, were discovered, and that led to the structure that I'll be talking about today. So I'm mainly concerned with this issue of placing. The physical concern is this issue of placing a collection of D3 brains at a singularity and saying what I might get when I place that condition that collection at a singularity. So the reason we say collection is that typically if the vector bundle has rank n, the informal language which is used is that that consists of a stack of n D brains located at that point. Well, another historical step came in 1998, when Maldacena conjectured that the field theories, the gauge theories describing D3 brains, which happen to be conformal field theories, have a well-behaved large N limit. So N refers to the rank of the gauge group. And that large N limit is described by a certain anti-de Sitter space vacuum of type 2B string theory. Even having a discussion about a large N limit requires somehow writing down the UN theories in a way that's pretty much independent of N, or at least in which the N dependence is completely manifest. And we can see how that works in this particular case by writing the theory in terms of N, script N equal 1 supersymmetry. So I know that a lot of the audience is mathematicians. You're not used to these various supersymmetric field theories. In fact, the supersymmetric field theories with a small amount of supersymmetry typically have Lagrangian formulations. So you write down some Lagrangian, which is supposed to govern the theory, that's got things like kinetic terms for the the fields that are playing dynamical roles in the theory, interaction terms which explain how these fields are supposed to interact with each other. And then one does quantum field theory things, which mathematicians shudder at, and gets some kind of answer at. But the starting point typically is a pretty well-defined mathematical thing. Cases with larger amounts of supersymmetry are much trickier to deal with. However, the things like this maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, the so-called N equal 4 super Yang-Mills theory, can be written in N equal 1 terms and therefore described in this nice, clean mathematical language that I'm talking about. So the way I would describe an N equal 1 gauge theory, I need to specify a gauge group, which is going to be a compact reductive group. I need to specify a matter representation. I'm going to restrict to cases where all of the things on the representation are either bifundamental fields for a pair of local components. Local just means that the gauge group is locally a product of these components. Either bifundamentals for pairs of the local components or adjoints under single fields. There are other more complicated cases. One can try to analyze those cases, but the technology I'm going to write down today will make that assumption. And then the interaction between the fields is specified by what's known as a superpotential, which is simply the trace of a polynomial in those matter fields. So the matter fields can be multiplied because being a bifundamental or an adjoint representation essentially means that there's a map from between two vector spaces or from one vector space to itself. That's the way that those representations are described in linear algebra terms. So the components of the matter field can be thought of as homomorphisms among vector spaces, and then those homomorphisms can be composed if the source and target of the vector spaces of the homomorphisms match appropriately. And in that sense, we can write down a polynomial in the matter fields. So the case of this N equal 4 super Yang-Mills theory is actually pretty simple to write down. The gauge group is, as previously mentioned, a unitary group UN, and there are three matter fields, X, Y, and Z, each taking values in the adjoint representation of that group. So that means I've got an n-dimensional vector space someplace, and X, Y, and Z should be thought of as n by n matrices, essentially, variable over space-time. And the superpotential, which governs the physics in this particular case, takes this form, which you already saw in Jim Bryan's lecture 2 hours ago, the trace of XYZ minus XZY. Now, you may wonder about the apparent asymmetry of this, but actually, because I've got a trace there and I'm multiplying matrices, I can cyclically permute any term without changing the answer. So really, that implicitly involves terms such as YZX and ZXY with a plus sign, in terms such as ZYX and YXZ with a minus sign. And if you were to write all those terms out, you would see everything as being completely symmetric. Okay, that's just what we had. So if we write things in this form, and of course, you know, technically I should have had indices on my X, Y, and Z because each of them is an N by N matrix, and then the fact that I can do the multiplication is the fact that I'm matching indices all around, and the trace is just pairing the remaining indices that haven't been taken care of by the matrix multiplication. I've suppressed those indices. Even if I put them there, the formula would be pretty much independent of n, except for the fact that the summation that I have to work over is from I, j, k equal 1 to n. So the n appears only in the sizes of the matrices, not in the way that they're being manipulated. And it's that basic structure of these theories which allows one to even talk about what happens for large n to compare the theories for large n. In particular, when n goes to n plus 1, we'll take the n by n matrices and embed them into n plus 1 by n plus 1 matrices. Same thing for the gauge fields, and that gives us a nice way to take a limit as n gets large. So one of the things which comes out of the analysis of these theories is a set of what are called classical vacuum solutions for this gauge theory. For a classical vacuum solution, you need to specify a constant value for each of the X, Y, and Z. X, Y, and Z were fields varying in space-time up until now, but when you look at the classical vacuum solution, you want them to be constant. Each of them is a matrix. It's an N by N matrix. But then, in this theory with that superpotential, there are so-called F-term constraints in the N equal 1 theory, which simply say that you need to set the partial derivatives with respect to the variables of that polynomial, their traces, that is, equal to zero. So how do I set the partial derivatives equal to zero? Well, how do I calculate partial derivatives? Well, I have to take into account that cyclic nature of the polynomial that I mentioned. So if I want to take the derivative of the first term in there with respect to y, I cyclically permute to put the y in the front, and then I pull off the y. So although this is a non-commutative polynomial, obviously, since it's matrix valued, it's a non-commutative polynomial, I'm taking what you might call left derivatives, but I'm taking them left derivatives up to the cyclic permutation. That all makes sense because of the trace in evaluation of the thing. Okay, so a similar structure has been found for many singularities of Calabi-Yau threefolds. And to try to describe what the structure looks like, I want to introduce a so-called quiver graph. I'll put a vertex on the graph for each local component of the gauge group, and I'll put an arrow for each bifundamental or adjoint matter field so that that arrow indicates the source and the target of the given mapping. Now, I meant to put on my slides, and I forgot, the quiver for the case we were just doing, the N equal 4 case. So the N equal 4 case, I just have a single vertex, and then I have these three different fields that are called X, Y, and Z. And that's it. So that's sort of example one of the kind of quiver that we're talking about. And then in this particular case, the superpotential, as we just had on the board a minute ago, is the trace of X, Y, Z minus X, Z, Y. But there are more complicated things which happen when you work at different kinds of singularities. So when I assert to you that we know the data for the collection of D3 brains, there are various ways in which this is quote-unquote known in the physics literature. There are cases in which there's an orbifold of the N equal 4 theory, and one has a good technique for working out the physics if it was an orbifold from that theory. There are cases where it was a deformation of an orbifold from the theory. There are cases that come from toric geometry where there are some good techniques. I'll have a discussion about the techniques toward the end of the talk. There are a variety of ways that people have arrived at these field theory descriptions, but what I'm going to do now is just sort of tell you the form that they take. So, as I said, we need a quiver. We need to use the quiver to specify both the vector spaces on which these maps are going to act and the maps that go between the vector spaces. From that quiver, I can form what's called the path algebra, which is essentially just the algebra of all paths, including zero-link paths with arbitrary starting and ending points of the paths. So each path is a word in the generating fields that I'm writing down, my xj's, except for the paths that are zero length right at one of the vertices. So I need extra symbols for each of the vertices to denote those zero length paths. And then appending a zero length path, if the source or target is the correct thing, doesn't do anything. It's a projection operator it depends on whether I put it at the front or the back, but it's a projection operator onto either the source or the target in this algebra. So I take the path algebra of that quiver, all the possible paths that I can build that will follow the arrows, and then I mod out by these F-term constraints, these partial derivatives of the polynomial W with respect to the various variables, where I compute those partial derivatives by that cyclic method that I outlined to you. Now, with this kind of formulation, I can describe all of the classical vacua for all of the D-brain theories simultaneously. And the way I do that is I represent this algebra. Representing this algebra consists of specifying a vector space for each of the vertices Vj. Specifying that vector space tells me what the associated gauge group is supposed to be. It's supposed to be the product of the unitary groups. And then the other part of specifying a representation will be giving a homomorphism from V to V prime whenever I have an arrow that connects V to V prime. And then those homomorphisms are supposed to satisfy the relations given by the F-term constraints. So that's exactly the uniform structure that we saw in the N=4 case, and it will happen in all of these cases where people have worked out a D-brain algebra description of the D-brain theories. It'll happen in all these cases that you can describe uniformly all of the theories at the same time. That's one of the things which makes a large N limit sensible for these theories. Of course, we have, when there's more than one vertex in the quiver, we have not just a large N. We can imagine taking limits of various kinds, but the simplest one is to just let all the NJs be equal to N and then take a large N limit of those. There's a well-defined notion of taking all of those matrices, increasing their sizes uniformly by padding with zeros and so on, and we can study large N limits in all of these cases. So I like the term D-brain algebra for this particular class of algebras. They're sometimes called superpotential algebras. Superpotential algebra is just a quiver mod relations. I have in mind that these are the algebras which actually come from D-brains, and it turns out that if you write down a sort of random superpotential, then the random superpotential, although you can build the superpotential algebra, it won't typically be an algebra coming from D-brains. So there's not a real good intrinsic characterization at the moment, but we'll see some of the properties that these D-brain algebras have as the talk goes along. So one of the remarkable properties which they have, and this is something which there's no sort of there's no systematic way to verify, but every example that I've ever checked, it's worked out. The remarkable property is that the center of the algebra is the coordinate ring of the Calabi-Yau threefold. So let me say that again because it's really important. The center of this non-commutative algebra, which I got somehow from some physics calculation, turns out to be the coordinate ring of the associated Calabi-Yau threefold. So what we're really studying here is some kind of non-commutative extensions of coordinate rings of algebraic varieties, and that's the point of view that I'm going to take when I try to globalize and learn how to put these things together beyond just cases that are sort of like affine cases that we're discussing here. On the other hand, the description of these algebras in terms of superpotentials, even having a superpotential description, is really closely tied to being dimension 3. So, for example, we'll see in a minute what the classical vacua are, what the algebra structure is in this N=4 case, and it's pretty clear that it only works for three dimensions. So for some purposes, it's convenient to look at more general algebras that simply have the property that the center is a commutative algebra of finite type. In that case, the spec of that center will be some affine scheme, or if you're nervous about schemes, now I'm talking to the physicists in the audience, you can make it a variety by imposing a mild condition of equal to its radical. But the key thing is going to be, as it was in the general setup, the category of representations of the algebra. That's where we're going to get all of the information about the structure. And so, you know, there's several things going on. One is to have good techniques to figure out what the D-brain algebras are, and the other is to recognize that it may not be the algebra itself that's so crucial, but it's the set of representations, or the category, rather, of representations, which are the crucial item. Let me just say, I've got it written down later. I'll say it now. Okay, so here's example one of an interesting algebra whose center does what I like. It's not quite an example of a D-brain algebra. I'll modify it to be an example of a D-brain algebra in just a couple of minutes, but it comes from the Mackay correspondence. So if I have a finite subgroup of SU2, so that the group is acting on the polynomial algebra generated by little x and little y, there's a nice construction that one can make called the twisted group algebra construction, which consists of pairs of a polynomial and a group element, which compose according to the rule that I've written here. So you have a sort of twisted product because you use the group element to modify one of the polynomials before multiplying the polynomials together. And that turns out to be a good algebra structure on this set. Kapranov and Vassaro interpreted the Mackay correspondence, which gives this beautiful relationship between the representation theory of the finite group G and the singularities of C2 mod G, they interpreted this, by the way, singularities of C2 mod G are clearly related to this polynomial algebra. The group invariance CXY super G will be the coordinate ring of the singular space. But the Caprano-Vassero interpretation was that we can decompose the twisted group algebra as a sum over irreducible representations of a certain module for that algebra tensored with the representation itself. So that tensor with the representation is maybe not so familiar. The example I'll do in detail in a minute is the AN minus 1 example. In that case, all of the representations are one-dimensional. It's just a decomposition of the twisted group algebra. But in general, for example, in the D cases, you have to worry about multiplicity and sort of pay a little attention when you're doing the computation, but it can all be done. So the structure is determined by the graph of representations that Mackay used. Mackay's story had a graph of representations which were connected by whether tensoring with the two-dimensional representation, whose coordinate ring is CXY, telling you which other representations you got. So when you tensored with that two-dimensional representation, you got to other representations. And here in this picture, that's supposed to be part of a larger big cycle. I just represented part of it. So I've got the various irreducible representations. I've written it out for an minus 1. And I've got an x and a y emanating from each of these representations. That tells me, well, if I tensor that representation with cxy, it tells me that the x part goes over to this representation and the y part goes over to that representation. And then I've numbered them all because these are really maps from different representations to different representations. So I've got this kind of quiver structure. And in fact, the whole graph is a cycle, and there are some natural relations that you work out on this graph relating the representations of G to each other. And that is that if you, with my notation, compose xi, yi going around that way, or you compose yi minus 1, x minus 1 going around that way, you get the same thing. You'll notice that I've drawn my graphs to compose backwards from how people usually compose. I get so confused about that. In fact, because I've drawn things here from several sources, that might not be consistent in all my examples. I apologize for that. I really do like commutative stuff. Anyway, so from this description, you can work out the center of the algebra without too much trouble. I've been claiming that the center of the algebra is a nice guy, and in this particular case, the x's are, if you follow the x's all the way around the cycle and then take cyclic permutations, you get something from the center. If you follow the y's all the way around the other way and take cyclic permutations, you get something from the center. Or if you do a sum of these xi, yi guys, the ones that agreed no matter which way we did it, sum of that all the way around, we'll get another element z. And it turns out that z to the n is equal to xy. So the center was, in fact, the invariant subgroup, CXY super G. This is a familiar description of the AN minus 1 singularity as being written in this form, so it's not unexpected, but it's kind of cool to see it come out of this sort of Mackay-type diagram of the homomorphisms that are gotten by tensoring with CXY between representations of this group. Okay, so with that as a kind of warm-up for the kind of algebra that we're going to see, I now want to give some examples of D-brain algebras. So one we've already given. It's this one that was the N equal 4 super Yang-Mills theory. If I actually take those partial derivatives now, if I take the partial with respect to x, the way I've written it here, it's obvious that it's going to be the commutator of y and z. If I take the partial with respect to y, I get the commutator of x and z. Partial with respect to z is the commutator of x and y. So the F-term constraints impose commutativity among the variables, and the algebra that we get is just the familiar commutative polynomial algebra in three variables. If you think about it for a little while, you'll realize that there is no superpotential of this sort which will enforce commutativity among k variables where k is not equal to 3. So if you try to do it, you've got, you know, if it's bigger than 3, you've got too many commutators to deal with. There's just not a way to do it. And so that's why the superpotential formulation, as I've been stressing, is really kind of unique to three dimensions. Nevertheless, certain parts of this construction work nicely in lots of different contexts. Okay, so the category of representations would be the just C, X, Y, Z modules. And if it's finite dimensional, they'd just be given by triples of commuting and by N matrices. This quiver and the stability issue and so on, all that Jim talked about, so I say nothing. I was going to say nothing anyway, but now I have an excuse for saying nothing. Going back to the Mackay quiver that I just spent some time working out, so that one, because it's two-dimensional, you cannot put in superpotential form, but you can if you add loops. I thought I added the loops. Nope. You can if you add loops to the diagram. So what I had before was this cyclic guy with the arrows going in both directions, sort of going all the way around a cycle. And what I have to do now, in order to promote it to a three-dimensional situation, is to add loops at each of the previous vertices. Jim also drew that picture during his lecture. If I sort of supplement the relations that I had, so these were the relations that I had, if I multiply each of them by the corresponding loop, then I end up with a polynomial which exactly enforces the relations from before. So no relations are enforced on the phis, it turns out. The only relations that are enforced are these quadratic relations among the x's and the y's. We end up getting the same algebra tensored with a free algebra on the phis. The phis, by the way, commute with each other because each of them has its source and target at a different vector space along the quiver, different vertex along the quiver. So they automatically commute with each other. The things which commute with everything, the center, well, there you need symmetry among the nodes, so you have to add up all the phis. And you end up with a central algebra, which was the original invariant algebra, tensored with a new free guy. As I said, the behavior of the algebra is very, you just tensor with C of the commuting little phi i's, the previous algebra. So from physics, this is known to be the field theory description. If I put the D3 brain at a point on a curve of an minus 1 singularities on a Calabi-Yau threefold, or at least it's approximated by this, and here we see exactly which Calabi-Yau threefold it is. It's the same one that Jim again wrote down. I told him after his talk that he was going to recognize a lot of things in mine. I take this space, C2 mod G, which has the isolated singularity, and then cross it with another copy of C, whose coordinate ring is this C of phi, and I get what I'm finding here in example 2. So here's another example where the center is producing exactly the coordinate ring that we expect. Here's a modification of that example. In this modification, I've decided, well, to make life simpler, I restrict to the case of A1, so now my cycle just becomes an over and back, and I've got two loops going over and two loops going back, and I've got them labeled with X's and Y's corresponding to the previous labeling. And now I'm adding, of course, I had to add these phis at the end. They're the phis that got added at the end. And now I'm simply going to add some terms to the superpotential. So this is what I was actually kind of warning people about a few minutes ago. You can't add things arbitrarily. You might have thought, hey, what's the problem? I could just, put any old arbitrary deformation. In fact, the thing will really fall apart if you use different polynomials in the two little phis. But if you use the same polynomial in phi 0 and phi 1, you end up with another valid case. It's a case which I'm not arriving at by accident. It was actually calculated from two points of view by Cachazzo, Katz, Vaffa on the one hand and by Aspinwall, Katz on the other hand as being associated to a particular class of singularities. I'm going to derive the singularity for you by working out the center just now. But the way this was found was the opposite, that first you start with the singularity, you get the superpotential, and then you kind of go back and check that everything works. So I just wrote down the partial derivatives of my superpotential there. And that one, You know, if you're really, if you've got a good memory, you could memorize W and then there are its partials. But the chances of your checking that these are the central elements from that in real time are zero, but I promise you they are. And so you get a relation among the central elements, which turns out to be exactly this, z squared equals xy plus z times the derivative of that p. That's a reasonable thing to show up because it's showing up in two of the partial derivatives, the ones with respect to phi 0 and phi 1 in my f-term relations. Okay, so that's the equation. And that's an equation which is it's a singularity closely related to flops. It's something that has two small resolutions, and the flop relates them. The small resolutions are rational curves whose normal bundle is O plus O minus 2, provided that P has a 0 of order at least 3 at phi equals 0. And that's the class of singularities which Cacciasso, Katz, and Baffa wrote down the partial superpotential for, and Aspinwall, Katz finished the calculation with other methods later on. Okay, what if I had a 0 of order 2 instead of order 3? Well, that's going to be the standard flop, the one with normal bundle O minus 1 plus O minus 1. The singular point is called the Konefeld singularity, often in the physics literature. And I could just deduce it from the previous one by a standard physics trick. Namely, I've got a quadratic term in my superpotential. It lets me eliminate the superpotential using the F-term equations. And then I substitute back in and get a different presentation of the same algebra. So I don't need the phi in the algebra. And you end up with a much simpler superpotential. Well, after canceling a bunch of stuff, you end up with a simpler superpotential. And it's a superpotential which was the first one of these beyond orbifolds to have been derived by anybody. It was found by Klebanoff and Witten in 1998-ish, 8, I believe. And again, it corresponds to this quiver, this what many people recognize as the standard Konefeld quiver, a special case of the above constructions. Another early example was done by Plesser and myself. It's a singularity which is called the suspended pinch point. I'll explain the terminology in a second. The suspended pinch point singularity is this is a singularity given by this toric data. So there's a toric diagram. It'll give me, if I don't do any resolution whatsoever, it'll give me some kind of singular toric space, the cone of regular functions described by this data. The regular functions described by this data, its spec will give me the singularity. And using these techniques that I alluded to of somehow getting all toric singularities out of orbifold singularities, this was the first example of that that anybody did. Plesser and I worked out a quiver and a superpotential. There's a parameter in here, lambda. The lambda parameter, I don't even really remember why there's a parameter in this example. There's a parameter in this example. And there's a superpotential. So let me just remark that starting with that work, there was a huge industry founded to work out D-brain theories for singularities of various kinds. And it turns out that the methods that were originally used to find these superpotentials were rather cumbersome. And so there was a lot of technology devoted to finding efficient ways of working out what the quiver and superpotential might be. Hanani and collaborators were major contributors to this. And it's been ongoing up until quite recently, people finding new classes of things that they're able to make good computations about. In the large n limit story, for those who know this part of physics, it's a really nice example of gauge gravity dualities, so-called ABS-CFT correspondences. And that's one of the reasons that it's been of a lot of interest. Okay, so back to the example. Again, I wrote down the F theory, the F-term constraints, and I managed to write down central elements, and I got a relation among them, and I got a lambda in my equation. So I guess I get a whole family of things. There's some scaling involved, which makes all these isomorphic to each other if lambda is not equal to zero. I actually literally copied from the old paper, the 1998 paper, the superpotential with the lambda so that I would, you know, have something to refer to. But that's the suspended pinch point. And it's called that because a pinch point, a surface singularity, is AB squared equals a square. So if you write CD as a sum of squares, the suspension is to add another square. So that's why it's called a suspended pinch point. Okay, the last example I'll do is the most recent one. It's worked out in a paper that was released on the archive yesterday, or Thursday night if you like to read them in the evening. It's a hypersurface singularity which is not toric and not related at all to toric geometry. There haven't been a lot of cases of this theory worked out in the absence of a toric structure, and so it's one of the reasons why we wanted to do this. There are three or four related examples in this paper that are new, but I've just taken the simplest one. So the singularity in question is another flop, but it's a flop whose normal bundle is O1 plus O minus 3. And it's actually the second flop of that kind that was ever written down. The first class of such flops was written down by Henry Laufer. This one I wrote down in collaboration with Henry Pinkham in the late 1970s as a sort of simpler version of Laufer's example. So there are various ways of describing the resolution of the singularity, why you get a P1 and why it has that strange normal bundle. But the nice modern way of doing it is to use what's called a matrix factorization. So I'm starting with an affine hypersurface equation here. It happens to be a canonical threefold singularity. And this particular hypersurface is irreducible, which means that you can't write it as a product of two polynomials. But there are polynomial-valued matrices which multiply to a diagonal matrix the identity matrix times this particular polynomial. So that's a matrix factorization. And I've written it to fit it on the screen. I wrote it in this way. A diagonal of x's plus this guy, diagonal x's minus this guy is equal to the polynomial times the identity, 4 by 4 identity. And there's this sort of slightly complicated polynomial. The nice thing about having a matrix factorization is that it lets me describe a module over the coordinate ring. So the co-kernel of either of the maps, let's just choose one, will describe a module over that coordinate ring R. That's the CXYZW mod F. And if I take the sum of those two guys, the trivial R module R and this new R module M, the endomorphisms of that algebra turn out to be a D-brain algebra for this particular singularity. So we could describe it as a quiver. I've got these two. I'm using the letters of the modules analogously to the Mackay story that I had before, where some auxiliary representation theory told me how to write down the quiver. We wrote down the modules. We calculated. It's a little tricky, right? We calculated HOM RM, HOM MR, and endomorphisms of M. Those are the components that you would expect to see. It's not so hard to show that there weren't any endomorphisms of R other than ones that are generated this way. But that statement means things like, if I do D followed by A, B, A, A, B, 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 and then come back with C, I get an element of R. And all of the endomorphisms of R had to be writable as linear combinations of words of that kind. So it's really not an easy thing to work out that you've correctly identified the superpotential. Our techniques included calculating Hilbert polynomials for the various endomorphism rings, and that sort of let us check. Well, actually, we also used some non-commutative Grobner bases, which I didn't even know existed. That let us check that we really do have a complete description in this particular case of this ring expressed initially as an endomorphism ring as a quiver. And we had relations. We found the relations in the course of giving that description. And then we were able to find a superpotential which exactly generated those relations by partial derivatives. So here's, again, a case. Well, I forgot to write it down, but you can work out what the center is, and you can find elements capital X, capital Y, capital Z, capital W, which generate the center, and the usual phenomenon that the coordinate ring of the center is what we're getting what we hoped for works for this example as well. Okay, so I want to make a few remarks about this whole thing. First remark is that the algebra is not uniquely determined by the D-brain configuration. So that's one of the reasons that people spent a long time developing technology in the toric case. Even in toric cases, it turns out that there can be more than one description of the set of possible D-brains. Those descriptions can involve different algebras. And there's a phenomenon in N=1 gauge theories known as cyclic duality, which turns out to be closely related to this change of ring and the relationship between the corresponding D-brains. Second remark is, I start with, I guess I didn't use the word Lagrangian, but I start with this very explicit description. You write down a Lagrangian, which involves kinetic terms for gauge fields, and matter fields, which involves interaction terms that explains how everything interacts together. So that was summarized by this data of the group, the representation, and the superpotential. And then from that, there was a calculation which lets me, at least conjecturally, lets me get back to the algebraic geometry near the singular point where I was placing my brains. But it's also possible to go backwards, and this is typically where the calculations have been made. Well, I should say that a lot of the technology in the toric cases is this funny blend of guessing and checking. So there aren't complete proofs that the methods work, but the methods certainly are working. It's clear from examples that they're working. But there is a systematic way to go backwards due to some work of Aspinwall and collaborators. You have to look at the coherent sheaves on X supported at P, probably its derived category. You have to determine a tilting module for that derived category. That's what I was doing in my case, my explicit case a minute ago, where I had R plus M. That was a tilting module. And so if you can find a tilting module and make some computations of the X groups, well, the tricky thing is then getting a kind of minimal generating set for those X, which will give you actually a quiver that can be described using a superpotential. There's an alternate point of view about the superpotential, which is an A-infinity algebra structure that lives on this derived category. And in principle, you could work out what the A-infinity algebra structure was. In practice, that also seems to be pretty tricky to do if you want to know a specific algebra for a specific example. To the best of my knowledge, there's no algorithm to compute the center of one of these algebras. I'm writing down an algebra which is path algebra mod partial derivatives of some non-commutative polynomial. I don't know how to compute the center of that. I've done it in lots of cases, and I showed you a bunch of the answers, but I'm not sure how to systematically find the center. I'm also not aware of an algorithm for producing a tilting module for the derived category of coherent sheaves supported at P, excuse me, not X. Supported at P, right? Again, if you've got a tilting module, great, you can check that you have one, but actually finding something that's going to classify as a tilting module is pretty tricky. There's been a lot of interesting progress on that question in the toric case in the last couple of years, but in non-toric cases, such as the ones that Aspinwall and I just did, we were lucky that the matrix factorization module produced a tilting module for us. If that hadn't worked, I'm not sure exactly what we would have done to continue finding a tilting module. And as I've mentioned a couple times, although it seems to be a really interesting feature of all of these examples, that the center of the algebra that governs the structure of the D-brains is the coordinate ring of the algebraic variety, there's no general proof that that's the case. So a very general form of this story has been conjectured by Vandenberg, and he conjectured that if you have a canonical singularity in dimension 3, there is an algebra A whose category of modules describes the coherent sheaf supported at P in the way that we've been discussing, if and only if there's a resolution of singularities which is relatively Calabi-Yau, which is crepant. And he's proved that conjecture in a number of cases. So his conjecture is more precise, and I've just stated it. He says exactly what kind of algebra you should expect to be getting. However, the form in which he makes the conjecture is really a nice form coming from pure algebra, and it doesn't address the interesting question of whether that algebra could actually be described as a quiver mod superpotential relations. In particular, So saying that an algebra can be described as a quiver is simply saying that it's finitely generated. And that's not a real issue. If you've got a non-finitely generated algebra, you should have changed your definition so that it was finitely generated. The real issue is, if you've got a set of generators, figure out what all the relations are, and then determine if that set of relations can be, determine if some generating set of relations can be written as the partial derivatives of some fixed polynomial. Again, that's something which there isn't really any technology for doing, but which can be done in practice in certain kinds of cases, but again, I don't know the general result. Let me mention another property which is key for Vandenberg and which is satisfied by all the examples that occurred here, and that is that this non-commutative algebra A has finite global dimension. So generally speaking, when you're looking at commutative rings, commutative algebras, they'll have finite global dimension only when the associated algebraic variety is non-singular. Here we're getting a nice class of non-commutative algebras with which are closely related to some algebraic varieties which have finite global dimension even though the underlying algebraic variety is singular. And that's one of the key ways in which I would claim that specifying one of these non-commutative algebras is really an analog of resolving singularities and producing additional structure in addition to the singular variety that you have, which behaves a lot like a non-singular algebraic variety. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I'm going to discuss possible ways of globalizing this business. Before I can globalize, however, I have to learn how to localize. So I'm expecting whatever class of algebras I look at to be to have centers which are the coordinate rings of corresponding algebraic varieties. So a natural question to ask is how these things behave under localization of the underlying variety. I can localize at any element of the center just by using a right tensor product over the center with the localized center. So that just means I let F be a denominator. That's okay to let F be a denominator because F is in the center, so when I try to multiply various elements in the algebra together, I can shift the denominators around to wherever it's convenient in doing the calculation. So let me do an example. I took one of these twisted group algebra computations, the very simplest one associated with Z2 acting on C2 by multiplication by minus 1, and I wrote out again for you the capital X, capital Y, capital Z, the elements of the center, which are now a little bit simpler than they were before. Let's see, did I reproduce the quiver? No. So the quiver, we had the quiver on the board or on the slide a few minutes ago. The quiver has two arrows going one way and two arrows going the other. And the way this is, the way the numbering goes, this one is x0 and that one would be y1. And then going backwards, it's x1 and y0. So the combinations that I've written down there are the center, and they're subject to the familiar relation for an A1 singularity, z squared equals xy. So now I want to localize at an element of the center, and I'll choose to localize at capital X. So if you localize at capital X, then the equation for the center, of course, lets you now solve for y. All I'm saying is that if I stay away from y equals 0, I no longer have a singularity here. And so that's my localized center. If I want to understand how the twisted group algebra behaves under localization, well, a small calculation convinces you that little y0 and little y1 are no longer essential because they're elements of the localized center times little x1 and little x0 respectively. So I can generate the whole algebra with little x0, little x1, and capital X, capital Z, and capital X inverse. And now it turns out, if you examine the relations, well, the key one is that x0, x1 plus x1, x0 is capital X. That's the guy that's inverted. And that suggests a natural representation for this algebra. I've written the homomorphism the other way from the algebra of 2x2 matrices with entries in the center to this algebra A localized at X. So there's the homomorphism, and it turns out to be an isomorphism. having localized the algebra at X, I ended up with a matrix algebra. So that might be a little discouraging from a certain point of view. It was a little discouraging to me initially, because what we'd like to do is somehow glue these together. So we're finding non-commutative extensions of the coordinate ring near a singular point, but when we localize away from the singular point, we're not recovering the coordinate ring of the non-singular variety anymore. Instead, in an example like this, and it's actually a general phenomenon, we're discovering a matrix algebra in that coordinate ring. Well, here's the way out. There's something called Morita equivalence. I will say I'd heard this term, but I didn't really know what it was until I started looking into non-commutative algebras a few years back. And the reason that we don't know what it is if we're commutative algebraists is that it's a triviality in commutative algebra. So two rings are Morita equivalent if there's an equivalence of categories between the left A modules and the left B modules, two rings A and B. And if those were commutative rings, that turns out to imply that A is isomorphic to B. So it's only in the non-commutative situation that you start to realize that the category of modules may be a more fundamental object than the rings themselves. The simple example of Morita equivalence is that if you have a commutative ring R and you take the matrices, the n by n matrices in R, those are Morita equivalent. It's not completely obvious that those would be Morita equivalent, but going one way is easy. It's not so hard to take. Which way does it go? Anyway, it works. I don't have time to remember which way is easy. One key fact is that when you have Morita equivalent rings, their centers are isomorphic. That's a generalization of the fact that if they're commutative, the Morita equivalence is a triviality. In fact, you get this relationship between the centers in all cases. And so in the case of R and MNR, that's pretty obvious. The center of the N by N matrices is the diagonal matrices with equal entries, multiples of the identity, multiples by R. So that's the equivalence in that case. So how I'm going to apply this here is pretty clear. When I localize away from a singularity point, I obtained not the coordinate ring, but a Morita equivalent ring to the coordinate ring. And if what I care about is modules rather than rings, that's good enough. So that's why I'm hopeful that the following strategy for globalization will work. So the construction that I want to give is going to exploit the fact that I've got Morita equivalence at my disposal. And I want to give some kind of construction of non-commutative algebraic geometry in some limited context, which goes in the following way. Let me just comment that lots of people have tried non-commutative algebraic geometry. I wouldn't want to be quoted on how interesting or deep the results seem to many people who do ordinary algebraic geometry. But it hasn't been a highly successful theory. Let's just put it that way. And I think from this perspective that one of the reasons is that people have tried to glue together ring spaces. And when you had a non-commutative ring space, you had trouble gluing it together. Well, I'm not going to glue together ring spaces. I'm going to glue together the sheaves on those spaces rather than the spaces themselves. So I want to define some kind of non-commutative spec. I don't know what it means. That's the model space. And so I have to tell you a sheaf on this non-commutative spec. And essentially, I'm going to tell you a sheaf on the underlying spec of the center. Okay? And I'll do that by specifying a pre-sheaf. And the pre-sheaf is just going to be localize the module at F and get a module over the localized ring. So that gives me some class of what I might call quasi-coherent sheaves by analogy with the commutative case, a model set of sheaves defined on these affine non-commutative spaces. Now I want to patch them together, but when I patch them together, I won't require an equivalence of rings. I'll only require an equivalence of categories of modules. So the gluing should be two things. One is, if I'm going to glue two of these affines together, I need an isomorphism between the centers of the rings. But I don't require an isomorphism between the rings. I only require a compatible isomorphism between the module categories. So Andre Calderaro has pointed out to me that this construction has a lot of points of contact with stacks, at least if you take the right set of rings. And I'm not sure yet if this is a new perspective on stacks or a generalization of stacks or a generalization of some stacks or how exactly it's going to play out, but I just wanted to mention that it may be that although I'm focused on this particular property, the structure that I want is a close cousin of something that already is out there in the literature. Anyway, I hope I've convinced you that there's some interesting class of non-commutative algebras which are related to singularities of algebraic varieties. They've come from physics, but I think they can be studied on their own merits in algebraic geometry. The fact that we have lots of examples which come from physics should actually help us to make sense of this theory. And I hope that I'll be able to report in the near future on a more complete theory along these lines with an S. Sorry for the typo. Thanks for your attention. Yes. Right. I have not considered that question. Well, that's sort of a general feature, right? So, I mean, I guess the case, right, so the case where we could talk about that in some detail quickly would be these cases, where I took and added a polynomial term to the A1-hat singularity. And, of course, in this particular class, I can vary those, so long as I vary the polynomials together, I can vary them pretty much however I like. So that's unusual. A lot of times you take what looks like a perfectly reasonable thing to add to the superpotential, and when you add it, it completely messes everything up. But here I've got a large class where I can actually do that deformation. And I could take a deformation of P to having isolated double points, I guess is what I would want, and everything should track. So this is an instance where everything would track, but I'm not sure what conclusion to draw from that. This one, yeah. That's right, but you'll notice this one is, you know, it's cubic followed by some arbitrary polynomials in a couple of fields, whereas the one from our recent paper is, you know, degree five, degree four, a couple cubic terms. I mean, I don't know how to relate that structure in any fashion to the conifold that you just mentioned. Yes? The rings from the, I kind of hinted at it at the end. So the real way to construct these rings, the sort of mathematically sound way to construct these rings, is to find a tilting module for the derived category of sheaves supported at the point. And if you've done that, then the endomorphisms of that of that tilting module itself will have finite global dimension. And essentially the only things that you can get are built out of the sumands of the tilting module up to some isomorphism.